From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida Republicans are at odds this year over whether to hold a debate for the governor's race.
Debates are a very important part of people making up their minds, first of all, who to vote for, and more importantly, whether to vote at all.
Also this week, several Florida counties are pausing or even blocking plans for AI data centers, but some worry that won't stop the effects.
Because if they do it in Walton, it's still going to affect us here in Jackson. If they do it in Holmes, it'll still affect us here in Jackson, and vice versa.
We'll also talk about the impacts of a plan to drastically reduce property taxes, and we'll hear about celebrations for the Juneteenth holiday. I'm Regan McCarthy, on air and online. This is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida's Republican political world has been busy this week debating about debates. That comes after the state Republican Party announced it will not host one because only one candidate meets its metrics to qualify. WFSU's Tristan Wood spoke with political watchers about what's going on and the implications for this year's elections.
WUSF's Douglas Soule has been following the back and forth over the debates closely. I recently got the chance to ask him what's been happening.
So, Douglas, I know you've been following kind of the unfolding situation around this Republican primary, gubernatorial primary debate situation. Can you unpack it a little bit for us?
It's certainly a contentious topic now within the Republican Party here in Florida. We have a handful of high-profile gubernatorial candidates on the GOP side. Leading all of them, of course, is U.S. Representative Byron Donalds, who has Donald Trump's endorsement. There's also, though, Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, Investor James Fishback, and former House Speaker Paul Renner. Now, this controversy kind of really escalated last week when the Republican Party of Florida said that only U.S. Representative Byron Donalds met the metrics to participate in a debate. So that's something that the other candidates certainly were not happy about. And also not happy was Governor Ron DeSantis, who has now taken to criticizing the Republican Party of Florida for this decision, and even criticizing the chair of the Republican Party of Florida, Evan Power, in a social media post last week. He said that in a social media post over the weekend, he said that Evan Power was insulting the intelligence of Republican voters. So this is something that is very, very intense in terms of the combativeness between the opposing viewpoints on this right now.
I know that there's this kind of unsanctioned CBS debate that's in the works. What makes it unsanctioned and who signed on to it so far?
Well, I can tell you notably who hasn't signed on to it, and that is Byron Donalds. Byron Donalds' team, in a statement to various news outlets for this story, said that there's no participation trophies in politics. Another quote from their team was, quote, "It is not Byron's job to legitimize campaigns that have failed to gain meaningful support," end quote. And on the Republican Party of Florida side, and on their debate side, according to the party, the qualifications to participate in a debate are having 10% support in RPOF polling, more than $10 million raised, and more than 10,000 donors, which is something only Donalds has obtained. Now, there is that debate that you've mentioned, but certainly, you know, the full slate of candidates is not participating, and most notably, the most high-profile candidate, the one with the most money and support, Donalds, is saying, you know, he wouldn't participate.
Gotcha. Is there any political conversation about why Donalds isn't participating in this unsanctioned debate, and why kind of is there any like political speculation about as to the motivations for not participating in a debate as a frontrunner?
Talking to pundits, I think there's this general belief that it's when you're as far ahead as Donalds currently is in the polling that you have more to lose and potentially gain from a debate. I mean, let's think this is a different platform and a different situation, but let's look at the presidential, our last presidential election. Now President Donald Trump refused to do a debate. And so you had all the lower supported candidates hashing it out in those formats. So I think it's just, you know, he thinks he doesn't need a debate to win. And the other candidates who have less public support right now certainly have more to gain from a debate by, you know, directly talking to and talking against the man currently leading the polls.
Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
No, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Tristan.
While Donald has said he has no interest in participating in a debate, the majority of the candidates running in the race are pushing for one. Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins has criticized the state Republican Party for its decision, and candidate James Fishback has launched attacks at Donald's himself. Fishback recently showed up at an event Donald's was attending to heckle him about the debate. It's not the first time Fishback has attacked Donald's. Fishback has used racially charged language against Donald's, who is a black man, such as calling him a, quote, slave to Israel. I asked Susan McManus, a professor emerita in political science from the University of South Florida, to weigh in on the political implications of the situation.
The debate situation. What do you make of all with all that going on?
Debates are very an important part of people making up their minds, first of all, who to vote for, and more importantly, and whether to vote at all. And debates are seen as a primary responsibility of candidates. If there's an offer to debate, very few people turn it down because obviously there's human nature. If you turn down the opportunity to debate other candidates, it looks like you have something that you don't want the public at large to know. So it ends up being a somewhat negative or bad taste feeling among voters when they see a candidate that doesn't seem to be wanting to participate.
One of the loudest voices for this debate, for one of the candidates, is that James Fishback character that's been getting a lot of, you know, saying a lot of racially charged stuff about Donald's and has, you know, gotten some condemnations from top Republicans in the state. What do you think the prospect of, you know, him being in the debate and kind of what environment that would turn the debate into has over this kind of conversation?
Well, that's certainly a concern, is that it becomes a racial debate. And obviously that's the last thing that Republicans want. But Fishback himself is a problematic candidate that's the equivalent of what some Democratic candidates in other states are being cast as, people who are out of touch and not reflective of the sort of feelings of the party at large. So the fact that Fishback has called Donald's certain terms is of concern, and Donald's will have to make that clearer and clearer that if this gentleman is included in the debate, then I'm not going to, or here's the reason why, and explain that this is not what the party needs to be focused on.
You know, kind of the Democrats have coalesced around David Jolly. You kind of think that fighting is good for Democrats?
Well, they have their own problems with other races, but, you know, obviously they're going to try to capitalize on it. Democrats still have a big problem of, you know, the edge that Republicans have in terms of registered voters. And there is a history of Republicans turning out at a higher rate than Democrats. That's certainly been true in the last few cycles. But that's why Republicans worried a lot about this. Does this alienate people who might normally vote, you know, to stay home in the general election? So that, I think that's the really the cloud that's hanging over all of this discussion at the moment.
Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
You're always welcome. Take care of yourself.
That was WFSU's Tristan Wood speaking with University of South Florida Professor Emeritus Susan McManus. The debate over AI data centers is taking place in communities across Florida. Some have pressed pause on any decisions about the centers that power artificial intelligence. In rural Wakulla and Jackson counties, commissioners have passed an all-out ban following pressure from community members who worry about the center's water use and environmental impact. But as Randy Vuxta with WFSU's Rural News Service reports, experts say bans won't stop those impacts from crossing county lines.
Wakulla County is home to one of the largest freshwater springs in the world. Roughly 400 million gallons of water pour through Wakulla Springs each day. And each year, hundreds of thousands of tourists flock to its cool waters and marvel at its unique flora and fauna. But resident Jason Robinson, who spoke at a recent Wakulla County hearing on the issue, worries an AI data center could take all of that away. He's also worried about the fishing industry, which has been impacted by water issues in the past.
Add in the fisheries out here and the damage that could be done to this right here. I mean, now you're looking at the ecological system of this whole area right here. And it doesn't matter if it's on that end of the county or this end of the county.
Across the panhandle in Jackson County, residents like Elijah Simmons voice similar concerns. Simmons says he's glad to see the community taking action, but he'd like to see more.
So I think Jackson County leading the charge, both the people and our commissioners signing this ban, it's inspirational for the counties all around to kind of, you know, do a similar thing. Because if they do it in Walton, it's still going to affect us here in Jackson. If they do it in Holmes, it'll still affect us here in Jackson, and vice versa.
Data centers use a large amount of water to cool off the mega computers that power programs like ChatGPT. While bans will help keep Jackson and Wakulla County residents from seeing the centers in their own backyards, experts say that doesn't take care of those water concerns entirely.
The water that, you know, we rely on is all ultimately connected in, if not above ground, below ground.
Aaron Ryans is Associate Dean for Environmental Programs at Florida State University. Most of Florida sits above the Floridian Aquifer. It's one of the most productive aquifers in the world, and it's where the majority of the state gets its drinking water.
So if there, and we're, as a state, we are all connected. If there is a water emergency in the south, but there's water to be had in the north, the state could authorize, you know, water transfers in various ways.
Ryan also says the concerns is not just about water being drawn out of the aquifer to cool data centers. It's also about what's being put back in.
There are all these other problems. The water that is used to cool data centers is going to be returned eventually to the environment if it doesn't evaporate away, but it's going to come in hot, and that hot water can change the environment it returns to. It can change the ecosystems. It can threaten aquatic life.
Ryan says hot water is considered a pollutant under the Clean Water Act, and she says the water will likely contain other pollutants as well.
There are additives that are used to prevent the water in these cooling mechanisms from, you know, prevent algal growth and whatnot, and those are pollutants as well.
Walt Trierwheeler works with the Office of Public Counsel, which represents the public on issues concerning utilities, water, and wastewater. He says, despite some communities passing bans, data centers are likely coming to Florida, which is why, he says,
it's so important that we get it right, that we let the right companies in with the right plan and the right operation. And then that would be wonderful for that community.
A new state law that goes into effect next month that gives local governments more control over where and whether data centers can be built in their communities. It also puts rules in place to ensure the companies behind the centers foot the bill for any added energy infrastructure needed, and the law puts some environmental and water use protections in place. I'm Randy Vuxta.
Jeff Brandis, a Pinellas County Republican who served for 12 years in the Florida Senate, isn't holding back on his analysis of a proposed property tax overhaul going before voters in November. Brandis is the founder and president of the nonprofit Florida Policy Project. He recently joined the Between the Lines with Derek Ham podcast from State Affairs to discuss how the property tax plan could significantly change who wields power over local government spending.
This is the largest taking of home rule. This is effectively the end of home rule,
right,
for certain counties and cities in the state of Florida.
Right.
I think that this is going to cause counties and cities to merge, right? Because there's just no way, if you're poor old little Liberty County with 8,000 residents and the average home in Liberty County is $200,000, like, this whole leg of the tax school is now cut off for you.
Well, right? Let me ask you, for listeners and for myself and for a friend, why should it matter to folks if a little city is consolidated into a county? What is the real world impact? Right. Well, or I mean, if counties are consolidated into other counties, other than that there's, you know, two sheriffs might be running for the same job.
Yeah, for the last 100 years in Florida, our deal was local communities get to make local decisions and get whatever taxes generated in those local areas is spent locally, right? And that has been the contract between the states and the local governments for local control over the past few generations. That this fundamentally shifts that contract. And the governor admitted this, right? I mean, he stipulated to the fact that there are counties that will not be able to survive. That's why he created the whole trust fund kind of mechanism, right? Because he knew that we were going to have to backfill these things. Well, my argument is, well, when the government, when the state takes over, when the state sets your budget, it sets your priorities. It is effectively taken over your local government. And so we now go from independent local governments to dependent local governments. Mm-hmm. And not only dependent local governments, but dependent over local governments that are on an allowance from the state. There is total obscurity as to, okay, when I need to hire 10 police officers and I have funds for five, where do I get that money from? Well, how do I go to the state? Is the state must hire those other five, or it may hire those other five? That's an open question, right? How are we going to fund the basic, consider core services of government in these counties that are still growing, that are predominantly homesteaded, like Volusia, like Sumter, mm-hmm. that, where 60-70% of their properties in the community are homesteaded, and they don't have a tourism base. They don't have a large industrial base of commercial properties. This is the kind of open question that nobody knows. Right. Nobody knows.
That was former Senator Jeff Brandes speaking with podcaster Derek Ham. If voters decide to put the proposed property tax cuts in place, experts say there could be an unintended consequence: more mosquitoes. WLRN environment editor Jenny Stiletovich reports.
If you stop mosquito control here in the Florida Keys for 2 weeks, you would see, in the summertime, you'd see what it was like in 1950.
Phil Goodman is the chairman of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District. He's been on the district board since 2011. He's a chemist who worked in the chemical industry as an executive for decades.
Mosquito control is probably one of the most misunderstood government organizations in Florida because nobody really connects the dots.
As part of the referendum proposed by Governor Ron DeSantis and approved by the legislature, mosquito control districts that rely on property taxes could see a big chunk of their funding disappear.
We're looking at one-third of reduction in revenue. And the bill did have language in for core functions, but it was very unclear if mosquito control would be considered a core function.
Sherry Burrows is vice president of the Florida Mosquito Control Association and a former director of the Indian River Mosquito Control District. Being designated a core function would mean the districts provide an essential service that can't be cut.
We don't have an alternative revenue stream. We don't have the ability to backfill.
And mosquito control managers know what can happen when mosquito control gets cut.
We got a sobering update on Zika today. The nation's top health officials warning that the Zika virus appears to be a lot scarier
another
than
another locally
thought.
Transmitted case has been discovered in Florida, this time outside the containment zone. And authorities are now using planes to.
And the head of the CDC says mosquitoes carrying the virus are harder to wipe out than officials first expected.
A decade ago, Miami-Dade County became ground zero for the first outbreak of deadly Zika virus in the continental United States. Before it hit, the county had cut its mosquito control budget in half.
It's still way underfunded there.
Goodman says that's because people don't usually connect the dots between mosquito control and a healthy economy.
Because nobody was here in Florida basically to know how bad mosquitoes were before mosquito control or how bad they would be today without mosquito control.
Before government-run mosquito control, people would fend off bugs by carrying around smudge pots or old cans filled with burning grass or peat. Malaria and yellow fever were among the leading causes of death in Florida.
There was a Virginia Congressman John Randolph. He made a very famous impassioned speech on the floor of the House in 1821. And he said, and I'll paraphrase, he said, nobody wants to come to Florida. Nothing but quagmires and swamps full of alligators and mosquitoes and diseases. No man would ever move to Florida, no, not even from hell itself.
For the next century, Goodman says Congressman Randolph was mostly correct. Swarming mosquitoes were so bad in the 1920s that a real estate investor in the Keys built a bat tower, hoping to lure an army of skeeter-eating bats.
No bats came, see? There were no bats. We baited it and none came.
This is Fred Johnson explaining in a 1986 interview provided by the Wolfson Archives. Johnson had built a 30-foot tower on Sugarloaf Key for his boss, the investor and largest landowner in the Keys at the time, who dreamed of turning Sugarloaf into a fishing resort, but for the mosquitoes.
So bad that you just raked them off your arms. You didn't try to strike them or anything like that. They were just so thick.
Local folklore here in the lower Florida Keys is that the mosquitoes ate the bats.
About the same time, after a statewide outbreak of dengue fever, Goodman says Florida began establishing mosquito-controlled districts. The first was in Indian River County. Operations mostly focused on battling swarms after they arrived, which left most residents fleeing inside at dusk and waiting for the seasonal fogging planes and trucks to arrive.
We have been moving heaven and earth to get the planes into the air.
This was Dade County Mosquito Control Chief Fred Stutz in 1957, explaining why irate residents were still waiting for relief. This interview is also from the Wolfson Archives.
We hope that people will be patient and eventually the trucks will get to them. The difficulty with the trucks is the fact that we cannot cover the large areas that we can cover with the airplanes.
Since then, Goodman says mosquito control has undergone a renaissance.
We have entomologists, we have biologists, we have zoologists, you know, working. So it is a real complex science. But we also have people that go out into the field, into the marshes, and do testing.
Mosquito control managers don't wait for the mosquitoes to arrive anymore. Instead, they fight them before they're born. They use larvicides and maintain surveillance networks. They investigate new controls like releasing sterile mosquitoes to reduce the population. Modern fogging trucks make routine runs, often quietly before dawn, without notice. The state's 15 mosquito-controlled districts also serve as unofficial hubs for mosquito intel for county-run programs.
We share our knowledge to really make Florida right now number one in mosquito control in the United States. But, you know, we still have problems. Diseases are still our main concern. You know, if you look at a map, all of the diseases come really from the tropical areas. And, you know, here in the Florida Keys, we are a tropical climate. But Florida is really the only area in there that has really overcome the problem of mosquito-borne diseases.
Goodman says Floridians now spend about $330 million a year on mosquito control, mostly through ad valorem taxes, county by county. The Keys, which has a fleet of 5 helicopters, spends the most per square mile at $20 million a year.
It's a lot of money. But when you look at the tourist economy that you have and the real estate market and the property values and all of these things, it is one heck of a good return on investment to Floridians.
With funding cut, he worries that could change fast.
The mosquitoes in the Everglades, they breed at about 45,000 per square foot. If you can imagine, 2 billion per acre, basically. And this is not just once a year, this is like every 10 to 14 days.
Goodman and Burroughs, with the Mosquito Control Association, say they asked lawmakers to designate mosquito control as a core service to preserve funding. But the final draft passed by legislators left the language vague. This month, lawyers in Broward and Miami-Dade counties filed a lawsuit challenging the referendum, saying large parts were misleading or unclear. They've asked a judge to order Florida's attorney general to rewrite it. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week, Juneteenth, the federal holiday observed each year on June 19th, marks the end of slavery in the United States. Events in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami are focusing on how Black people express their existence on the heels of the 250th anniversary of the United States. WLRN's Wilkin Brutus has more.
Power.
That's a clip from last year's Juneteenth Experience, a concert theater production from Huge Songs. It's a South Florida nonprofit celebrating Black culture through music, dance, spoken word, and short films. Their flagship annual program commemorates Juneteenth in Broward and Miami-Dade County. Celebrating history through the arts helps communicate Black stories more broadly, says founder and executive artistic director Cunha Rowley.
At its core, art really allows people to make sense of the world and also to see themselves reflected back into the world that we want to see.
Rowley says the theme of this year's Juneteenth experience is called We Too Sing America, a line inspired by a poem by Langston Hughes called I Too.
I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh. And I eat well, and I grow strong. Tomorrow I'll sit at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
That's legendary actor Denzel Washington reciting the Langston Hughes poem in the 2007 film The Great Debaters. Rowley says it's a reminder that Black history, Black identity, Black music has always been built into the fabric and the tapestry of the United States, but often begs the question, who is America and who gets to say so?
And so certainly as we look ahead to the 250th anniversary of the United States, you know, I hope that people walk away with A, of course, experiencing this really incredible, amazing performance, but also being able to be a little inquisitive about how we think about history, who gets to tell it, and how we define, you know, whose history is told.
That same sentiment is shared in Palm Beach County. The Juneteenth Unity and Black Excellence Festival in West Palm Beach is returning for its sixth run.
We've created a safe space for all these years for people to walk freely, connect. It's like one big family reunion.
Founder Sakina Kelly says the festival, which is put on by her nonprofit Juneteenth of Palm Beach County, is one way to establish in-person community through small business vendors, food, and live entertainment.
So that's why we're calling it a homecoming. We've been saying that from the beginning, that it's really a big cousins link up. And I love that. For the community just to have that space to just be.
Kelly said Juneteenth celebrations are about more than festivities. It also reflects the lasting impact of racism, especially housing discrimination, which limited Black ownership and wealth building across generations, according to the Brookings Institution. The festival, in its own way, attempts to address material conditions, supporting Black-owned vendors, networking, and instill confidence among the people in the community.
I love to invite everybody from all different walks of life because Black history is American history. So when you come to the 6th Annual Juneteenth Unity and Black Excellence Festival, not only are you participating in culture, you're participating in pride.
The cultural leaders say the Juneteenth celebrations seek to continue amplifying Black history and civic engagement amid the 250th anniversary of the United States. I'm Wilkin Brutus in Palm Beach County.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Tom Flanagan, Tristan Wood, and Randy Vuxta. Thanks also to Jenny Stiletovich, Wilkin Brutus, and Dara Cam. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Regan McCarthy. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.